Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Epochs of the Load Seaters, where Bo and I will today be discussing the legendary King Richard the Lionheart. How's it going?
Yeah, good.
It's been a long time coming,
this will be a good one, hopefully. Or it'll probably be more than one episode, actually.
Yeah, probably three episodes. So his early life, the Third Crusade, and his later life, and then death.
Yeah. Well, so to begin with, he obviously is one of those people that towers over history. He's got a good shout for being the most famous English king, you could say.
He's definitely the most romantic English king, isn't he? Like, there's this heroic romance that's built up around Richard. Which I think, by the way, cards on the table, I think it's entirely deserved. Because I've read many biopics and books about Richard the Lionheart, just because he's a fascinating character. And in no way does he seem to not actually earn and deserve the appellation that he has, even from his enemies.
Yeah, no, he's some sort of embodiment of chivalry, kind of hero of men. Richard the First haters are usually the same people that... just despise the British Empire themselves.
Weasley men.
Yeah.
Who wear spectacles and a lot and have never thrown a ball in their lives. I know exactly the kind of people who Richard haters are.
Yeah. And it was only really until the revisionist stuff on Richard is mostly 20th century stuff.
Really? It's mostly communist subversion. What a shock.
I saw something that the British hold dear and try and subvert it inside out. The idea that he's gay, for example, there's just no evidence for that whatsoever.
He's married to multiple women.
He was predatory heterosexual. Yeah.
He was a typical Plantagenet guy.
Yeah.
Liked his women, liked his wine, liked his fighting.
In fact, let's address that right away, off the bat. Yeah. The reason, there's one line from Roger of Howden, who's a chronicler at the time. There's one line. That's quite often what revisionists do. They find one line from something
that can be interpreted in many different ways.
Yeah.
And they extrapolate from that.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I know I'm jumping in, but this really bugs me.
So the line is that where he was very close friends with Philip Augustus before they fell out in the earlier life. Roger of Howden says, Philip so honoured him that every day they ate at the same table, shared the same dish, and at night, the bed did not separate them, end quote.
Oh, they must be having sex then.
Right.
I mean, this is a modern prejudice where everyone has their own space.
Mm. Yeah, their sense of privacy was very, very different.
Very much so. In the medieval era, an entire family would sleep in a bed.
Mm.
Why would you have more than one bed?
Mm.
Really weird thing to say.
Mm.
Like, for us. But for them, they would think it's weird. Why do you each have your own bed? Don't you get cold at night? Well, you don't have central heating. So it actually makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? You know, we who have always had central heating, I'm getting a bit cold, I'm just going to turn the thermostat out. That wasn't actually an option in a 12th century castle. Mm-hmm.
Also, it was very, very symbolic. A well-known, any historian that just jumps to the fact that that's sort of homosexuality or something is deliberately forgetting the well-known thing that for politics, often you would share, two men, powerful men, would share a bed because it was a show of trust.
Yeah.
And that's what it was between them, that you share the same meal and you share a bed. Nothing sexual about it.
No. And the one reason you share a meal is so you can show it's not poisoned.
Mm.
Like, there are lots of actual practical reasons to do these things. And genuinely, it's absolutely freezing in a medieval castle.
Another thing they would do that sounds really weird to us.
Yeah.
But sometimes to show their friendship or political alliance, they'd wear one massive shirt. They'd stand right chest to chest, and this massive shirt would be put over both of them for a brief period.
That does sound weird to us moderns.
But again, it's showing that It's just showing trust.
Yes.
That's what it is. But yeah, even in The Lion in Winter, there's an element that they say that Louis and Richard might have been lovers, but there's no evidence whatsoever for it. In fact, all his detractors at the time, they there's various things they could criticise him for, and not once was it ever to do with sodomy.
Yeah.
Because if you are, if you are accused of being homosexual, it's just explicitly levelled against you.
Yeah, and they love it.
And it never was.
They love levelling that accusation because in the Middle Ages, that was a deviant, dirty accusation that was difficult to shift.
You'd be known as John the Sodomite or Roger the Sodomite or something. Yeah.
And in Richard's life, no one ever said that to him because why would you say that to Richard? Oh my God, he's going to beat me. Yeah.
They said he was a womanizer and a philanderer, but not
average Plantagenet.
At different times, different places and different times in history, homosexuality is more or less a problem. You know, in our day and age, it's almost actively encouraged, isn't it? In ancient Greece, famously, classical Greece, it wasn't too much of a problem. In 11th, 12th, 13th century Europe, it was an affront to God. You're close to being a heretic. You're spitting in the face of God. It was a real no-no.
Deeply unnatural behaviour.
Right, right, yeah. Really bad.
Unchristian behaviour.
Yeah, yeah. So the fact that it was never levelled against him. But there is that one line, and 20th century, like sort of 1950s, 60s subversives said, oh, he's gay.
Yeah.
He wasn't gay.
No, it's just that they are porn-brained and they're gay. That's what it is. Right. It's like two men in a bed. Well, they must be putting things up each other's whoopsies. It's like, no, that's just not how it works, actually.
Mm.
Like, anyway, so...
Anyway, so that casting that aspersion aside...
Our medieval Achilles, just like the other Achilles, wasn't gay, actually. Sorry to be a bearer of bad news to the gay community.
So other than that, for centuries, and at the time, largely, he was considered a brilliant, brilliant king, the superb ruler in all sorts of ways and facets.
Yeah.
Nicholas, historian Nicholas Vincent, calls him impossibly glamorous. Simon Sharma, who I loathe, also called him the superstar of the dynasty.
Evidently so.
That he outshone Henry II before Henry II was even dead, which is not easily done because Henry II is, you know, one of the most powerful men in the world, certainly in Europe. Yeah. And his own son, second son, outshines him like with ease, really.
Yeah. Henry won a lot. So if you can make him look like he's playing second fiddle, you must be pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like, you know how perhaps some superstar athletes are lionized or put on a pedestal. He's like a superstar athlete, but also like a war hero, a Medal of Honor winner, a VC winner.
Oh, what,
and you're king all at once.
But more than that, though. Like,
yeah, but more
It's one thing being like, oh, yeah, I was in a battle, I was wounded, or I got a Medal of Honor or something like that. That's very impressive. But it's another thing that for 1,000 years afterwards, people are like, well, he was leading the charge into the Turks here. He cut a sway through the Turks here. And all of his men had real trouble catching up with him when he was storming Acre or whatever. And it's just like, this is actually like Pyrrhus levels of maniac, like war fervor.
Mm.
Like he really enjoyed war, physically enjoyed the fighting of war, and was always at the front and just... You can tell this was his jam. You know what I mean? This is what he got off on.
I've got a few quotes saying exactly that. Yeah. He loved it.
Yeah.
He actually loved it.
And he was obviously built for it as well. He's this huge guy, ultra muscular, handsome, you know, ruddy, bloody Norman king. It's like, okay, put him at the front.
Yeah. Well, I had a quote lined up for a bit, but I'll read it now.
Yeah.
Winston Churchill wrote, "Richard, with all his characteristics, virtues and faults, is cast in a heroic mould, is one of the most fascinating medieval figures. He has been described as the creature and embodiment of the age of chivalry. In those days, lions were much admired in heraldry, and more than one king sought to link himself to their repute. When Richard's contemporaries called him the Coeur de Lion, the lion-hearted, they paid a lasting compliment to the king of the beasts. Little did the English people owe him for his services, and heavily did they pay for his adventures, for he was in England only twice for two short months in his 10 years' reign. One thing we can say there, that was just during his reign. Earlier in his life, he was in England loads. He was raised in England until he was 8 years old. So there's another thing. He was never in England. Well, there wasn't much work to be done in England in terms of putting down wars and rebellions and revolts during his reign. So he didn't need to be.
Well, this is the...
But he actually spent loads of his childhood and loads of times before he was crowned in England. So that's another aspersion, which is a sort of a nonsense.
Yeah, but it's an aspersion that people don't realise is a massive boon towards Richard's reputation.
Right, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I don't want a young king knocking around with nothing to do. Hmm. All he's going to do is cause trouble. All he's going to do is find taxes to raise. All he's going to do is get drunk and, you know, lech on people or something like that. Hmm. No. Go out and fight our enemies, please. That's actually your job as the king. And if you're not fighting overseas, then something's gone wrong because that means you're fighting here. So good. Oh, Richard's always overseas fighting the Saracen or fighting the Frank. Good.
Hmm.
That's an entirely positive thing. So he can leave us alone to run our lives.
Hmm.
That's exactly the kind of king I want. That's entirely to his credit. And one of the reasons that John sucks, frankly.
Yeah, right.
That John won't piss off somewhere else.
Exactly. When we get onto John, that's exactly the issue. Everyone's like, oh, he's always looking over us. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Like, sorry, yeah. I'd rather a Richard than a John.
Churchill goes on, yet his memory has always stirred English hearts, other than 20th century subversives, and seems to present throughout the centuries the pattern of the fighting man. In all deeds of prowess, as well as in large schemes of war, Richard shone. He was tall and delicately shaped, strong in nerve and sinew, and most dexterous in arms. He rejoiced in personal combat and regarded his opponents without malice as necessary agents in his fame. He loved war, not so much for the sake of glory or political ends, but as other men love science or poetry, for the excitement of the struggle and the glow of victory. By this, his whole temperament was toned, and united with the highest qualities of the military commander, love of war called forth all the powers of his mind and body.
And this is just a recurring pattern from every account of Richard I've read.
Mm.
You just can't talk about this man without talking about him as someone who's just born to it.
Mm.
You know, he clearly is just physically very well geared towards it. I mean, you know, someone of my stature, not really very well geared toward, but Richard's like, you know, 6'2" or something. Obviously, you know, big, broad dude, massive hands, like, you know, rugged upbringing. Okay, great. I'm glad we can produce men like that, to be honest.
And technically good.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know, you could be big and strong.
Yeah, but if you're not...
But not actually have much skill in fighting, whereas he did.
But he was trained really by William Marshall, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, trained by the best knight in Christendom. How fortuitous.
Another quick paragraph then from Churchill, just about, in general terms, about him. Just sort of set him up, set the scene. Although a man of blood and violence, Richard was too impetuous to be either treacherous, or habitually cruel. He was as ready to forgive as he was hasty to offend. He was open-handed and munificent in profusion. In war, circumspect in design and skillful in execution. In politics, a child, lacking subtlety and experience. His political alliances were formed upon his likes and dislikes. His political schemes had neither unity nor clearness of purpose. The advantages gained for him by military genius were flung away through diplomatic ineptitude. When on the journey to the east, Messina in Sicily was won by his arms, but he was easily persuaded to share it with his polished, faithless ally, Philip Augustus. Fruits of a victory which, more wisely used, might have foiled the French king's artful schemes. The rich, tenable acquisition of Cyprus was cast away even more easily than it was won. His life was one magnificent parade, which, when it ended, left only an empty plain. End quote.
That is the how to put it, the downside of being a bold and brash warrior who is loved by everyone is that you're trusting and naive and straightforward. Yeah. And that means that if you have... was Philip Augustus his cousin?
He was his cousin?
Yeah. What was the relation of Philip Augustus?
What, to?
Richard.
Oh,
I'm sure they were like cousins.
They were related. It might be distant relations.
They must have been distant and related in some way. But like, if you've got a foil in the King of France, who is also a young man, roughly, relatively young, and is kind of weedy and scheming, which Philip Augustus is, then you can see how the hero is going to get undone by such a person, which I don't want to spoil anything, although this happened 800 years ago. But that does kind of happen, actually.
It does seem Richard was pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
I mean, Churchill there describes him as a child politically, because he wasn't particularly into sort of deep layers, games within games.
No, it wasn't Machiavellian at all.
Yeah, it was just, I'll treat you straightforwardly as a man. I expect the same back.
And we'll have a battle.
Yeah, and if not, yeah, we'll come to swordplay, and that's about it.
Yeah. And there's something I quite like about this, because there are a few people who are so effervescent in their martial skills that they can afford to be like that. Right. But you do get those people. And again, he reminds me a lot of Pyrrhus, because Pyrrhus is very much like this as well, where he's actually just a nice guy who's just really straightforward and goes, well, look, we'll just fight about it. And, you know, God's going to decide the victor, which will be me. Mm-hmm. And then everything's sorted and everything was done honestly and it's all on the level. And that's how, you know, the will of the cosmos will have it. And of course, to anyone who's not a giant warrior, that sounds awful. Because they're like, okay, but I'm going to lose the honest fight. It's like, yeah, maybe, you know, but you'll lose honestly. It's like, yeah, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to scheme and backstab and manipulate. And the archetype that is the Richard sort of slash Pyrrhus archetype doesn't do that. But when they win, they're not bloodthirsty. They're not cruel. Mm. They are forgiving to a fault and manage to generate a great amount of love towards themselves, even if it's not from their contemporaries and it's from the people who are under them. So,
yeah.
And this is why Richard finds himself embedded in the Robin Hood mythos in the modern mind. It wasn't Richard who was the king in Robin Hood, but the modern mind assumed, okay, it's got to have been King John who was making the country terrible, where Richard will come back and fix it because he's good-hearted and John's evil. And so the thing kind of gets melded into one. And Richard fills that spot because of what he actually appears to have been like in life.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, and he seems to have been fair, fair-handed, and didn't hold match. Well, let's get into the details of his life.
All right.
I said last time that we go into his rebellions against his father. We'll a bit, but perhaps not too much, because there's so many details, so many great stories and anecdotes. In the last one, talking about Henry II, we mentioned the Great Rebellion of 70...
Before we get there, let's talk about his childhood, shall we?
Okay. Not much is known about his childhood. Well, very little is known.
I was going to say.
In those times, children need to shut up and be quiet and do as they're told, and that's it. And anything they've got to say is not of any interest whatsoever. So most chroniclers don't really say anything about the childhood of people in this period.
But also there's quite a good chance they won't survive childhood, which is probably reason for it.
We have got a few details and I can tell you about them, but there's not loads. No. You know, like, for example, in the story of Alexander, there's all sorts of stories about what he was like as a child and things he did as a child. We don't really have anything like that for Richard.
Right.
In this period, it seems, it was the case, that when you're a child, before you become a man, which might be about 14 or 15 or 16, but before then, you don't count almost.
Yeah.
You don't count. That's maybe a bit harshly, but yeah, no. So the things we know is that he would have had, obviously, a first-class education, which in those times would have meant languages mainly, and music, funnily enough. A bit of music, to be able to sing or play an instrument. But mostly languages and poetry and things. Apparently he was the favourite of Eleanor. And In the Lion in Winter, they play on that a fair bit.
Oh yeah, we haven't.
I was always your favourite.
stressed that enough. His mother's Eleanor of Aquitaine, phenomenally influential and powerful woman, utterly ruthless and capable in her own right. And of course, his father's Henry II, most powerful man in Europe. So he's got big shoes to fill, and does.
And he's got an older brother, Henry the Young King, who is expected to inherit. Mm. So Richard, until a certain point, until the Young King dies of natural causes, all his childhood and formative years, he would have been told, no, your older brother will be king, not you. You may well get duchies and things, but you won't be king.
Mm. And so luckily he's got the sort of temperance like, well, there's always something that a spare prince can do. in the medieval era, and that's go to war somewhere, possibly on a crusade or something like that. Mm. And so doubtless Richard would have spent a lot of his time mentally just thinking, okay, well, brother will be king. And he's probably not that bothered about it. Like, he strikes me as the sort of person who's not, like, going to nurse a grievance about that, you know?
Right.
And, like, because there are some who would be terribly bitter and sit there and plan how to kill their brothers and things like that. But Richard, I don't think, is that type.
No, there's no evidence that he ever planned or wanted to kill his older brother or anything like that. No.
So he obviously would have just gone, okay, fair enough. You know, I'll be the Duke of Normandy or something. And what can I do with that? Well, I can conquer a lot of France. You know, so that's doubtless what he was thinking of when he was growing up. So he would have had a martial education as well, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. I mean, if anything, these brothers were more likely to team up with each other against their father rather than against each other. But sometimes against each other, though. but yeah, not murderous.
No.
That's the thing about this Plantagenet family in this period, is they did restrain from killing each other. Loads.
Which is...
They could have... But there's a point a bit later, Richard could have maybe imprisoned or executed John. And he completely forgives him and gives him loads of land and stuff.
Yeah. Average Richard decision.
We'll get to that.
It's kind-hearted, but really, really foolish. But this is an interesting thing as well, which I really like. This is one of the reasons I find the Plantagenet family just endlessly fascinating. And I've got a lot of time and like forgiveness in me for them. Because it's things like this, because it's very easy for especially a medieval family where the stakes are really high, you're competing over kingdoms, you know, Western Europe is yours, it would be so easy to just murder each other. It'd be just the quickest and easiest route to solve all of the problems, but they don't.
Mm.
And these guys are very martial. Like, they all fight, almost all of them. Like, John's like the only one really in the Plantagenets who really stands out for being a bloody, you know, soft sword. You know, and that's, you know, he gets that nickname because he's not a warrior. But the rest of them are just martial men. And so the fact that they're not murdering each other every 5 minutes, when that's literally the natural habitat of the Plantagenet, is remarkable to me.
Yeah, during this period, the reign of Henry II and then later Richard, they didn't kill each other. Later, John does have one of his nephews, Arthur, killed.
Yeah.
So John breaks that mold. But the thing that springs to mind is I was... once again, listening to the audiobook of Dynasty about the Romans, Judeo-Claudian, Tom Holland, and he said that, reminded me that Augustus never killed anyone in his own family. He exiled a lot of them to remote islands, including his own daughter and stuff, but he never ordered any of their killings.
Mm.
Of course, as soon as we get to Tiberius and Caligula, they start killing people. So, but yeah, Richard didn't. Well, there's one point, I'll mention it now, but it's a bit later in the story. But at one point, John revolts, we'll probably get into it, it might be episode 2 or 3, but I'll just quickly mention it here. John revolts against Richard and brings him all sorts of headaches. And when Richard bests him, he says, you're forgiven, you're only a child. He was 27. And he goes, not only are you forgiven, I'll make you Duke or Earl of Dorset and Somerset and Devon. And have loads of lands, and so yeah.
John, if he'd cut your head off, everyone would be like, "Well, that's what he gets."
Right. Yeah. By rights, he could have either imprisoned him, exiled him, or even had him killed.
Yeah.
And
no one would have batted an eyelid because no one liked you anyway.
Mm.
So it's just like you are so lucky, so lucky.
Yeah.
But anyway,
John is lucky. Also, when after his childhood, when he sort of first appears really on the stage of history. It's during the Great Rebellion, which is like 1173 to 4, is it? And he's still only about 15 or 16 years old.
Mm.
And yet he sort of takes part in that, you know, as a chevalier, as a knight, well, in fact, Louis knights him before his own father does, but as a mounted man at arms, you know, and he's 15 or 16. I mean, as soon as you're strong enough, That's it. You're in the game.
Mm.
I mean, William the Conqueror was about 15 when he first sort of cast the shadow of his hand over his barons. Mm. It is quite young, but if you're physically capable and you've got enough force of character, force of will, you can do that stuff at 15 or 16.
And also,
just about.
If you're a young prince. this has been your entire life. Yeah. Like, you don't know anything else, actually.
Yeah.
And sure. I can tell you now, man, kids will pick up the system around them a lot quicker than I think we give them credit for. You know, like a kid will realize that, like sometimes my children try to tell me off. that, you know, when I, like, if I like go to the fridge and have like a bit of chocolate or something for dinner, you know, my kid will tell me off, right? You know, and he's right to do so because I tell them that, you know, you have that after dinner, and it's because the rules are explicit, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so if you've grown up in a courtly manner and you know all of the rules, by the time you're 15, you are going to be an expert in these rules. They're going to be all you know, mm-hmm. actually. Mm-hmm. And so
there's no... And it is all he knows. There's a quote a bit later, but you're exactly right. All he's known is sort of these petty wars that his father's been engaged in and what it means to be an Angevin king or a duke in the Angevin Empire. Mm.
Why this person has to be put down, you know, why this was an affront, and, you know, what you do about that.
So during the Great Revolt, which is basically the young king rebelling against his father, but everyone jumping on board with that, the King of France and all the different dukes of Flanders and even the Scottish king and things, and Richard jumps on board with it. There's one story at La Rochelle. There's the siege of La Rochelle. And again, he's only like, I think, 16 years old. And he sort of takes the town within a few hours or within one day. And again, personally sort of getting involved and stuck in. So straight away, he's sort of a martial leader involved in swordplay and things personally straight away. So it does seem that he's... You know, some people... leap onto the stage of history almost fully formed, it seems. Of course they're not, but that's sort of the impression you get. And it was at that time, just after that, that he's knighted by Louis of France. But as we said in the Henry II one, Henry II defeats everybody during the Great Rebellion. But he does forgive Richard, sort of course. So over the next few years, He is given, at one point he's given the Duchy of Aquitaine because Henry imprisons Eleanor. He needs someone to control the Aquitaine, so he gives it to Richard. And Richard spends the next few years sort of putting down all sorts of rebellions, keeping law and order really in the Aquitaine. There's one example of where there's some marauding mercenaries. Foreign mercenaries throughout Aquitaine. He sort of surrounds them, bests them, and then puts a lot of them to death, either by drowning or blinds a lot of them. Some people, again, 20th century subversives, say, look, here's a maniac, psychopath. It's like, no, that was good.
That was totally lawful.
That was the right, that's a good thing to do. That's the correct thing to do.
But it's
a lawful
thing.
These are foreign mercenaries going around raping and pillaging.
Yeah.
No, they deserve death.
Yeah, but it's totally lawful. Like, yeah, that's right. The thing. You know, this was totally within his remit to make this judgment of life and death on them. And like you say, there are a bunch of foreign mercenaries who are raping a bunch of Aquitanian women, plundering a bunch of, murdering a bunch of men. Kill them all.
Yeah.
Talking about.
Right.
Like, why would you even blink at that?
Yeah.
Subversive.
Sure. Yeah.
No sympathy whatsoever. You know, sympathy for the criminal comes out in spades. Why?
Our society is perverted so badly, isn't it?
That
you're immediately supposed to feel for the criminal. Like, how about no?
Well, remember, every single person who's ever attacked Richard the Lionheart has always held the opinion that the criminal is the victim of society. And I just don't agree with
that. No, not at all. Yeah.
So, no.
No, the criminal can be drowned or blinded or something. Yeah.
Depending on the severity of their crimes, absolutely.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about rape and murder.
Yeah, pretty severe crimes.
And pillage, stealing from innocent people and stuff.
Yeah, I'd have just hanged them all.
Yeah. So there's one of the other rebellions is at one point Henry wants to take the Aquitaine off of Richard, give it to John. And Richard sort of refuses. He's like, no, this is sort of my my beef. This is my, this is mine.
I spent all this time putting it in order.
Mm, come on. I will not give it up, and I'll fight for it if I have to. And so he does. Mm. Henry sends Geoffrey, the third son, and John down to the Aquitaine to fight. And there is apparently a fairly brief war, just one, I think one summer's worth of campaigning. In the end, he sends Eleanor down there. As I say, he was her favourite.
Yeah.
And just to convince him to sort of give up, because Henry doesn't want wars between his sons, to sort of encourage that sort of thing. Mm. And Richard does finally, eventually acquiesce and give it back.
Well, that's amusing as well. Right, I'm going to send my two sons down there to fight you. Okay, that didn't work. Send his mum.
Yeah.
Send his mum. He's the favourite. She'll be able to win him over. Yeah.
At one point, I'll quickly retell the anecdote. I believe we said this during the William Marshall one, but it's the great anecdote. When they came to blows, I think it was during that rebellion, outside the walls of a particular castle, and neither of them were wearing their full chainmail and plate armour. But they see each other, and they've got lances, and they charge at each other. And William Marshall does unhorse him. It looks like he's going to strike Richard with his lance, but at the last moment moves his lance to just impale the horse.
Yeah.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.